Welcome, everybody, to Steamy Stories, Intersecting Creativity. My name's Jessica Moore. I'm the Cultural Development Coordinator for Dubbo Regional Council, and I'll be your MC for today. First, I would like to acknowledge that I am coming to you from Tabaka country from within the Wiradjuri Nation, and I'd like to pay my respects to Elders past, present and emerging. I'd like to welcome everybody who's joined us today and welcome our panellists. Today's session, today's talk, has been put together as part of Science Week, which we're in the last day of Science Week today. And we're going to be looking at how creativity and science intersect and how the arts and science can better help support one another to investigate and uncover, and how we can use those two disciplines to explore stories of the human condition and the human experience. I'm going to now introduce our four speakers. First of all, I'd like to welcome Daryl Albertson. He's a soon-to-retire aquatic ecologist of the last 27 years and has become involved in the arts and exploring creativity as a way to address stress management, but also to uncover the potentials of art to tell a different science story in an alternative creative way. He believes that the approach that science, that the creativity can offer, can engage with a different audience and share different aspects of the scientific world. Daryl's practice can be found explored further at the website Artivita. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you, Jessica. Just acknowledge the land that I come from today, the Aboriginal land, which is Anawan land. And for the last 18 years, I suppose my focus has been as a wetland ecologist, moving away from aquatic ecology in Kamilaroi country out around Moree and the Gwaita wetlands and across three catchments of the Namoi, Border Rivers and Gwaita. Thanks very much, Jess.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome. I'd like to welcome Kim Goldsmith from Dubbo. Kim is a multidisciplinary artist who works across rural and regional territories of Australia and internationally. She has a particular interest in sensorial exploration and acoustomatic and hidden sounds of natural environments that potentially indicate the health and of a place or ecosystem. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Kim studies systems agriculture and journalism and has used this interest and knowledge to explore for more than 30 years the stories of rural and regional Australia. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Jess. I'd like to welcome all First Nations people who might be joining us today. I'm, like Jessica, based on Tubbagar country of the Wiradjuri Nation, and I work across a lot of inland New South Wales, across rural and regional territories. In particular, over the last few years, I've been working on Wailwyn country around the Macquarie Marshes, and I'm just starting another project at the moment that's very much based on the western edge of the Wiradjuri Nation. So my particular interest in the past probably 15 years has been sound, which takes me back to my days as an ABC radio reporter and my love of sound, but I also use video and I do a lot of writing because I've actually got a background in print journalism as well.
Welcome, Kim. I'd now like to welcome Scott Baker from Bermagui. He's a multidisciplinary artist working across three areas of practice: audio-visual composition using a variety of electrical devices and video games, video or sources, I should say, and you can find that at abriojos.net, creating site-specific video projection mapping installations and sharing the skills and knowledge of the creative industries with young people through the Bioluminescence Project. And again, you can find that at bioluminescence.net. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm based in Bermagui, as Jess said, and that's on Dirangange country, part of the Yuin Nation. But like the other esteemed panellists, really focus on working across regional areas. For example, the Bioluminescence Project is coming to Griffith in a couple of weekends, and we're going to be lighting up the Griffith Pioneer Park Museum with a bunch of young people over that weekend. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Scott. And finally, I'd like to welcome Rebecca Campbell from Armidale. Rebecca is an amateur cook, non-practicing scientist, an inconsistent reader. After studying and researching zoology, animal ecology, etymology, microbiology, excuse me, I didn't know how to pronounce that one, and climate change for 10 years in academia, she realized this wasn't the place for her and rediscovered her passion for creative writing, including creative nonfiction. She can be more about her work and her practice and some of her amazing writing can be found at cleverhelpfulbitter.com. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you, Jess, and my other panelists. I'm coming to you from Anawan country in Armidale, and I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, as well as elders past, present, and emerging. Thank you.
Thank you. So welcome to everybody who's now joined us and is watching at home. I'd love to begin with you, Daryl, and getting us thinking about what the arts and sciences are mandated to do. And one of the things that you have written about is that the art has the power to raise environmental awareness, that perhaps in areas perhaps the sciences can't do very successfully. And I wanted to pose to you, what do you think the arts and sciences role is? Is it a role to challenge and expose?
Thanks, Jess. I suppose if I look over my time in the environment field, we've moved from the hard copy material, things like your newsletters, your academia writing, the government communication that goes out to community, all trying to inform about what's going on or advise. But when I look and during those times as well, we had traveling photo exhibitions, we had traveling art exhibitions, we had all those types of things. But when you look at what's happening now with the multimedia, the platforms, the internet, all that stuff, it provides a really greater opportunity, I think, for the creatives to be involved in the arts. Now, I fundamentally believe that art component of the creative can actually engage on an emotional level on a subject. Mm. So if that's an emotional level about what the state of the environment is at the moment, where we're going on a particular population of species, things that we might have done for the environment to improve its lot. But on the other side of the coin, there's plenty, and we live on the northwest plains out to the west in Kamilaroi country. It's a huge growth area for production, cereals and cotton and all the different agricultural sectors. So there's a plenty of stories there too, that just like the environment, we could be, the creatives could be better engaged, I think, to tell the story to the communities about what's going on in those sectors connect in a different way than what we're currently connected, as I said, with those newsletters, the academia writing, the communications out of government and all the different fairly standard telling community of what's going on. I think the creatives have a role to engage better, and I think those sectors already think they're engaging, but in fact they're not engaging to take, I think, the current generations and future generations forward to actually, let's say, champion the lot of a particular species or a habitat or an ecosystem, or on the other side, where a particular agricultural industry is going.
I think this is something that I know, Scott, you've sort of flagged around. The arts are often included in the development of programs and one of the most famous examples is there are often artists included in Australian conflict, so that we bring the artists on that journey to tell that story of Australians during peacekeeping or during war. And one of the things that you've sort of flagged in previous discussions, Scott, is around how we bring, as Daryl said, bring the artists on that journey and how important it is to get the artists and the artistic perspective into these programs from a very early stage. Is that something that you think would be really important in helping the arts and sciences connect better?
Yeah, I'm all for finding solutions in this space around kind of what sits. And I think looking off at, other areas where there are artists embedded in practice that might not necessarily be creative. So whether that's, a military artist that you're talking about, or even how now there's some legislation around developers having a particular amount of their developer contribution fee that goes to public artwork once it gets over a particular size. All of those little things kind of help not only build that sort of creative industry and opportunities for artists, but it enables those new interpretations of what that information is being presented, whether that's a public space, so an artist responding to a public space or a development. But here we're talking about being able to present information at different levels. I've got a bit of a pedagogical background, and so one of the very first things that we learn is how people learn. So you've got your visual and your oral and your kinesthetic kind of learners, and we're sort of trained to be able to pick those in our classrooms and our learning environments to be able to tailor materials for them. It feels like a lot of that sort of science communication comes out at a one particular level, at one particular point. And so how do we broaden that scope to be able to cater for a number of different audiences to be able to sort of engage with it better?
And I'd like to sort of, this question is really to all four panelists around the, as Daryl talked about, the potentially emotional experience that art can bring to this knowledging, sort of developing and sharing. I'd love to get perhaps, Kim, your perspective on how, that emotional knowledge base on that emotional relationship to science and the environment and the sort of discoveries that science is making, that tends to be seen as art strength. Why do you think that's so important?
Yeah, look, I guess there's a lot of things that happen within science are often hidden. And just to give you an example, and this kind of taps into what Daryl's talked about in terms of floodplain ecologies, is when I was doing work in the marshes and I was looking at that first 12-month period of how the northern marsh of the Macquarie Marshes was recovering after drought and fire. And one of the things I was doing as part of that project, which meant that I was going back every 2 to 3 months to record both visually and acoustically that growing change as water came back into that environment. And I went out to an ancient coolabah tree, like hundreds of years old. It was enormous on the floodplain. And I did some sound recordings of that tree. And it got played back on radio in a few interviews, and a few other people heard it before it actually became part of a bigger work. And a lot of people told me they had goosebumps listening to the sound of that coolabah tree, because nobody had ever thought that that tree that has been sitting on that floodplain and witnessing so much change over hundreds of years had any sound other than the rustling of a few leaves. But you could hear the micro vibrations inside the trunk as it was sort of moving in the wind, and you could hear the xylem popping and crackling as water was starting to come back onto that floodplain. So that tree hadn't had any water for 3 years. And so I think that is a really powerful way to connect people with the backstory of what's happening in these environments. And I find sound is particularly powerful. So I've been listening to soils for the last 12 months and trying to share those recordings as well. And again, what happens beneath our feet is largely unregarded, even unless you're a nerdy soil scientist who really kind of loves digging a soil pit and getting their hands dirty, most of us never even think about life under our feet. But if you can hear it, it changes your perception immediately.
And it seems to be also very important that that exposure of these hidden worlds is happening in a place that is sort of accessible to people. It's outside of sort of strict academia. It's outside of overly verbose scientific papers or overly verbose even artistic papers or creative writing. So again, how important is it that this experience of the hidden science is made accessible to the general public? Why do you think that's an important aspect of what you as creatives are doing?
Well, I think Beck's probably got something to offer on this one. I think it's important because data alone is not going to change the world, and art alone is not going to change the world. But together, we have a really powerful opportunity to change the world.
Yeah. And Beck, some of your writing is, you know, one of those really amazing processes by which it's sort of hidden science, if you want. People pick up your books and discover a sort of hidden scientific world. Why do you include the sciences in your fiction pieces?
Even though I decided to leave my academic career before it had really begun, I still greatly value science. Like, it is very much a huge part of my world. So when I rediscovered my love of creative writing and started writing novels, it was almost just second nature to include some scientific elements in that writing. So I write in the women's fiction genre with contemporary romance elements. Now that, you know, is very much a booming industry at the moment. If I can weave some scientific, especially environmental messages into my stories, I'm reaching a far greater audience than I would have ever reached had I written a PhD thesis. And that's something a science friend of mine actually said. Way more people have read my debut novel compared to her PhD thesis. So I, you know, cover in my debut novel, I covered fossil fuel divestment and the renewable energy sector. That was a kind of plot line that unfolded through the entire story. And I also touched on artificial intelligence. The book that I'm working on now, to kind of piggyback on what Kim was saying about the Coolabah Tree, it's set on the island of Hawaii, and I've done a lot of research, reading scientific papers to learn about some of the environmental issues that are happening on particularly the big island of Hawaii. And I touch on the Ohia Lehua tree, which is endemic to the Hawaiian Islands. And at the moment, it's suffering from rapid ohia death, which is a fungal infection that actually stops the tree. It clogs the vascular system and stops it from being able to take up water. So it's not getting to the canopy. And these trees are dying within weeks and months. And it's a huge issue because the Ohia Lehua is it's a pioneer species after volcanic lava flows. It's one of the first big tree species to actually plant its roots in otherwise inhospitable land. And it kind of starts off rebuilding the environment in those areas that have been completely wiped out by lava flows. So little things like that I've woven into the story that I'm working on at the moment, just to bring awareness to some of these environmental issues. And it's done in what I think is a subtle way. And people pick up romance book for escapism. But if I can put across a message about the environment and what's happening on, you know, some of those scales, then I've reached someone who is probably not going to watch a documentary about the Ohia Lehua, or is not going to pick up a scientific paper because they're so often hidden behind paywalls and they just may not know it exists. So, yeah, it's just my way of contributing what I've learned about science and understanding science into a much more creative field.
So, Daryl, yes, Daryl, I wanted to bring you in here anyway, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I suppose I'll sort of also piggyback on what Kim said a little bit. So One of the things that I've been in awe of, I suppose, of our Western floodplain environment is that, and a lot of people don't sort of acknowledge it, I don't think, or don't recognise it. So if we want to engage with the wider community about our Western floodplains and those habitats, we really have to tell a better story in a better way so they do have an emotional connection with it. So the example I'll give is all those areas are in a semi-arid environment. So they have actually they've developed through eons the ability to make hay while the sun shines very quickly, more quickly than stuff over even on the coast and on the tablelands. Yeah. So in the semi-arid environment, it's almost like a semi-desert environment. So a couple of things that and working out in western floodplains and in the wetlands, two things that have really proven to me time and time again to be true. Give the environment half a chance, it'll self-repair. So you don't have to do much. You just have to give it half a chance and it'll actually do a fair bit of the work itself. And just add water. So particularly in these wetland areas, just add water and basically watch it bloom. In a matter of days, hours, minutes, these things bloom. It's almost like you're watching the old time series of the David Attenborough used to be big with, you know, the time series things over a number of days. This happens a number of hours. Yeah. So yeah, if we think about the current platforms that we've got available to us, the internet and web podcasts and all the different types, it's all visual. And I won't take anything away from you, Kim, and the audio stuff, but the visual if creatives were to capture that visual response or that response to water in a visual way, I think we'd engage a lot more on an emotional level with the people, get to understand semi-arid environment, just add water, give it half a chance, it'll self-repair, you know, take the stock off sensitive wetland areas, riparian areas, removing stock, you know, all the things that we know from the science need to be done, but we need to actually engage with the community to sort of the reasoning behind we're doing it. I think if people understood the reasoning and the visual, presenting a visual representation of how quick these things respond out there to being given half a chance and a bit of water, I think we could take the community into the future better with us, I think, with science blending art.
And I think that also speaks a bit to what Kim was talking about, this is sort of exposure of hidden worlds, that sort of so much of what we sort of know about our environmental sort of climate crisis is that we simply are told this is what's happening and we have our faith in the sciences to give us that factual data. But the ability of the arts to bring the visibility of that, what that actually physically means to different species, into our worlds is really profound and really impactful. And I know, Kim, you've talked about one of the things that you're interested in your practice is getting us as humans to be able to experience life from a different species perspective and have that empathetic engagement with the environment. Would you like to speak about how important that is for audiences to be able to engage and feel those experiences a lot more tactilely so that we understand them better?
Yeah, look, I mean, it comes from a simple belief that how can you care about something that you don't know either anything about or you don't have an emotional connection to? And I do dispute whether or not we trust science as much anymore.
Yes.
I think COVID kind of tested the boundaries of that a little bit. And, you know, you only have to spend 5 minutes on social media and look at the discourse that's happening to know that we don't blindly follow what we're told anymore. And so unless people have that really visceral connection to something, they're never going to understand it enough to want to care about it. And I guess, you know, one of the projects I worked on a few years ago was looking at human-shaped landscapes through the perspective of another species, which happened to be Australian and European ravens. And so I spent a year working with sensory and behavioural ecologists who were bird specialists and had particular knowledge of ravens. so that I could understand how to use the technology. And that included drones, it included 3D cameras, included a number of microphones. And so by understanding how these birds move through the environment, I was then able to go in and record those environments in a somewhat similar way. I mean, if anyone has seen my drone flying in Iceland, you would sort of wonder what I was taking. It was really difficult. And I was told that I would never, ever be able to replicate the experience of a bird and how they experience that environment. But if I could even get close and present that in such a way that it immersed people in those environments, then I kind of feel like I've half done the job, and at least we're a little bit closer to understanding the environments we live in from another species perspective. And it's really just about finding those multiple connection points of engagement and doing it in creative ways so that we do sort of stop in our tracks and go, what was that I just heard, or what was that I was experiencing? Because until people question what it is that they're actually engaging with, then it's just another visual. It's just another sound.
And yeah, I think it's also one of the things I'd like to bring you in here, Scott, around that importance of those relationships between creatives and scientists. You know, we can, as creatives, absorb a whole lot of data, but unless we really have those relationships with the scientists to understand how to interpret and contextualize that data, the sort of data is just numbers on a page. So how important is it, do you think, for creatives and scientists to work really closely together throughout an entirety of a project so that that data makes sense?
Yeah, I was working on a resilience project for the southeast of New South Wales, and we were getting all of this data in through from the climate scientists, and we'd done a whole bunch of kind of community engagement across the region to find out, you know, what resilience means to people, and you know, what are the things that they feel like they're kind of needing. And one of those things was, let us know what the risk is. What's our risk? What does that actually look like? And so by getting this climate data, this climate change data, down to the LGA level, we're still looking at spreadsheets. And so our conversation was like, we pull in a designer and we turn it into graphs, or we turn it into pie charts, or we turn it into some kind of visual element. And it's still not enough. Because I think, like you mentioned before, we have this kind of callus of looking at these things. And unless we're particularly drilling down, or we're looking to something to latch onto to write a funding application and justify what our project is, you know, these things just kind of go in one ear and out the other. And so it was interesting on a project to be able to sort of take that data and then go, how could I do a site-specific response to that information that people would have some kind of context of scale and size of it. And that came around by looking at sea level rise and picking a tree that wasn't too far from the beach, and then what would that actually look like. And I mean, and the sea level rise data is quite interesting because they don't factor in the complete collapse of the polar ice. They just kind of look at the sea level rise based on the warming of the oceans and what that natural expansion is of water. And so, you know, over the next 100 years, you're probably looking at about a meter and a meter and a half based on a middle of the road climate change prediction of it. But it still kind of gives people that bit of an idea of where you're standing now is dry, but even just a meter and a half, your feet are going to be wet. You know, like being able to kind of have a look at that and go,
humanize that data.
Yeah, but also in a place-based way so that people can kind of go, this is where I am. This is what that impact kind of looks like. And it's the same thing around, I think I did number of fire danger days and the increase of what that would look like, you know, over that kind of, from where we are now, 70 years into the future. I'm going to swing things another side, because we're talking about, you know, when we talk about the initiation of projects, so maybe it's a conversation with a scientist and an artist, but the other emerging space is citizen science and people that are really quite interested in their own. And so, you know, you're talking to the converted that might not have a scientific background, but are really quite interested around, you know, local issues. The Bioluminescence Project actually started based off a number of young people that were swimming underneath the Tafra Wharf and were down there with their GoPros and shooting vision of the life that had grown on the wharf pylons underneath there. And there was this imminent renovation of the wharf that was happening by the Bega Valley Shire Council to replace all of the wharf pylons because they were at the end of life. And so these young people were kind of like, what do we do? How do we draw people's attention to this? Because this is something that they're just going to close off the wharf, bring a crane in, pull a pole out, put another pole down, and then everything's got to kind of grow back again. And that was the initiation of the Bioluminescence Project, was how do we get young people that are potentially engaged with nature, or engage them with nature, and then, you know, bring that out in a particular way. And so we did a gorilla, I hope no one from council is listening. There was a PowerPoint on the outside of the Tafra Wharf building. We went down there with video projectors, got their video footage and projected it on the building. And so, you know, that got a bit of a crowd and, you know, a bit of momentum. And as a part of that process, council went a bit deeper into the environmental impacts. There was some testing that was done around putting ropes on so that some of the life could actually graft to the ropes, and then they could take the ropes off and put them onto the new poles to be able to kick it. And then, because we were talking more about how do we bring this into the visual, we've actually continued that process, and through the Valerie Taylor Foundation, we got a grant, and we're about to install a 24/7 camera in under the wharf. And as a part of that, we've also got some artificial reef walls. And so council's been quite amazing because they're going to let us bolt all of this stuff onto a few pylons in the center of the wharf. And in a few months, we're going to have a 24/7 live streaming camera to the world in front of these reef walls to be able to see that regeneration of that ecosystem in real time. So and that's all kind of coming from that citizen science. That's a bunch of kids swimming under the wharf going, this is our environment. And so now we've got this sort of other project that's emerged from it, and that's really exciting. Yeah.
That's amazing. And again, there seems to be this really consistent flow through of everyone's practice here is exposing all of these hidden worlds. And in doing that, creating this wonder for the natural world and for sciences in people who perhaps don't necessarily have that. So I think it's a really interesting way that, you know, the creative world is bringing this new set of eyes to things and exposing different hidden worlds. Daryl, I wanted to pick up on something that Scott said around the amount of data and the amount of scientific findings that is produced can kind of glaze over a little bit. It can kind of calcify, and we don't really connect with those messages as much as perhaps we should. What do you think is the role that art can play as someone who's worked in the sciences for so long to try to break through a bit of that calcification that's happening in the public around, you know, understanding what the sciences are trying to tell us?
I was sort of thinking when Scott was talking is we've been sort of going on the line on the green side of the equation, but we can't also negate that there's the brown side, the agri side. Now, there's plenty of science, there's big science that's been put in, and there's great wealth that's created on the Western floodplain from the agri sectors, and some great science to improve those industries in the way that they look after the environment and the way they produce. So if I think about that great wealth, and we're some of the creatives looking at some of the really good stories in the agri sector and what improvements they've done for their own sector might actually flow into also some commitment for funding for the environment sector to actually look at some of that long-term trend data and help the creatives to come out with that messaging. And I suppose one of the problems I see with the sciences in my field is that it does take a long time for the actual result of the science to come out. And most of my work has been really as a water manager and delivering water to different assets in the catchments and things like that, where I sort of need answers pretty quickly. And if I don't have an answer, well, I'll use my best knowledge and advice that's out there to actually make a decision. Mm. And the science comes a little bit later.
Mm.
And that's where those spreadsheets of all the data take so long, and then the academia comes in and to publish the papers. So I think I would rather see a very more fluid science where people are actually, who are out there doing the surveys or the analysis, provide a quicker product to for someone like who's a manager of the environment to make decisions that are better informed as we go through. So I'm not saying replacing the long-term trend data of a habitat decline or improvement, or with the science that's going around with the agri sector, but basically enable the creatives to into the fold. And I've got a bit of a solution that I'll actually tell right at the end.
Okay.
Might be a bombshell as well, but anyway, the solution at the end. I'm always trying to fix things. So is some way that the creatives could come in through the process. So allow your scientists to capture the data every month, every week, every fortnight, you know, three times a year, whatever it is. Create the data, capture the data, do the academia that they need to do. But somehow the creatives come in midstream and say, well, this is where we've got to now. This is where it looks to be going. We can produce some sort of product, whether it's visual, audio, or whatever, on the platforms that we've got available to us to tell the community what's going on, but also advise people like myself who's trying to manage the environment or has been trying to manage the environment as it's unfolding on almost a day-to-hour basis. I see that would be the role of the creative.
I think I would like to actually bring in one of the questions we've had in the chat, because I think it relates to this, and really encourage anyone who's watching, if you've got any questions, please put them in the chat and we'll try to get to them. But that bringing the creative in at various different points of a project's life can often have different, you know, outcomes. You can have different sort of measures of how that works. I'd like to get a sense from you all, particularly maybe I'll start with you, Kim, about how you have noticed or seen the ways that your creative projects are impacting audiences and are having some impact into the community. Are they changing hearts and minds?
Well, anecdotally, I think they are. I do tend to, coming from a marketing communications background, tend to like to evaluate things, even as an artist. And so, I mean, for example, on World Listening Day, I shared the baseline soundscape from the farm that I'm working on and doing a residency on over the next 12 months. So this was a midwinter. What does the farm sound like on a miserable, cold, wet, damp day in midwinter? And what was happening above ground and below ground? What was the atmosphere like? And I shared that as a video with an audio waveform on it that actually looked like coiled fencing wire. So there's lots of sort of visual tricks you can play with to sort of get that message across. And I did ask people, there was a very quick two-question feedback form at the below the video, and I asked people, did you feel connected with the environment that you just heard? And 95% said yes. I didn't really delve beyond that because this is, you know, very early stages in the project. But it'll be interesting to see over the next 12 months, because I'm planning on doing those particular sound releases on a seasonal basis, whether that continues. Now, I'm also not collecting personal data. So I don't know if it's going to be the same people responding all the time. I mean, I think you can certainly draw on some of those scientific feedback mechanisms in the arts to build into those projects that would actually give you some more solid information. But often just getting people to come to see something or taking it to the people to engage with is an indicator that you're having an impact one way or another. It's very hard to ignore something that's really in your face. And, you know, I've done pop-up public art events before where people who would never dream of stepping inside a gallery all of a sudden encountered a performative art piece on the street. You know, so if it's a projection, which, you know, lends itself to that sort of thing really well. And it often, it's the conversations that strike up on the back of that. Or those comments that people say, what even made you think that made a sound? You know, so that question that's really questioning what it is they've heard, to me indicates that I've cut through and made that connection in some way.
And Rebecca,
I think Beck's probably got a fair bit to add in terms of writing.
I was about to say sort of how do you, Rebecca, get that sense you mentioned before about, you know, colleagues telling you that your books are going to have more of an impact than a critical paper, an academic paper. How do you get a sense that your work is connecting with an audience and cutting through and exposing a new audience to some of these ideas?
I rely on reviews and ratings of the books, so which is like getting blood from a stone sometimes. And I have a presence on social media, on Instagram. So it's just how my writing is connecting with followers and, you know, what sort of comments they're leaving. And I'm certainly not focusing on the scientific elements of my stories on social media, but they are there. And what I've found interesting just within the last 5 minutes is when I wrote about artificial intelligence in my debut novel, a couple of reviews which left 4-star ratings actually highlighted that as a chapter that they didn't particularly think needed to be in the story. But this is going back a few years ago now, and I wonder if I was to release that book again today, given the threat artificial intelligence is to authors and book cover designers, how it might actually be received in kind of today's society where authors are, you know, having to face books that are written solely by ChatGPT and book covers where artists, like true artists, have missed out on designing book covers because someone has written some instructions into a box and, you know, a fantasy cover has been spat out. Might have too many fingers, but closely enough, you know, you might get away with it. But, yeah, authors and artists, visual artists, are losing out to artificial intelligence. So
it seems to be that would be the new, absolutely new emerging frontier of where the creative world and the scientific world are going to start to intersect a lot more, whether we like it or not, and however that spits out at the other end. It's a suddenly emerging new world that we sort of have to find our boundaries in.
And I think that's actually an opportunity though, Jess. I think there is an opportunity there. And I guess this is coming from somebody who works with technology as well. And Scott would probably be the same, that, you know, I think, yes, we have to have guidelines and frameworks around how AI is employed in the world, but that creatively, I think there are actually some really interesting opportunities there that could actually make that art-science collaboration even stronger.
I suppose one of the conversations that AI starts to raise, and it's one of the sort of, we've only got a couple of minutes, sort of 15 minutes left, so I want to sort of start to move into some of the last points. And one of them is around legacy. And one of the comments that Daryl made in a previous conversation, which I found really interesting, which is, when civilizations get very successful and very robust and very solid, they start to think about, well, what is our legacy? Who are we? What are we leaving for the next generation? And science and the arts are very much focused on those, you know, thinking about those next generations. And so I wanted to sort of bring Daryl, you in here around what sort of role do you think the arts and science have in sort of setting and supporting and validating a form of legacy, and how would that go about happening?
So if we've only got 15 minutes left, I might just mention what my solution is, I suppose.
Please
if,
do.
That, yes. If you're happy to do. And it sort of does speak to the legacy of things. So Scott talked about an embedded artist in the military, and they've been there for as long as there's been military, I suppose. And I think Kim in a previous conversation mentioned think tanks and embedded artists. But given the level of environmental aspects across the Western floodplain and the agri sector, which is the wealth of the economy out in that area, there's no way we could hope to embed creatives within each one of those sectors. But what I would think, if we turn that around and we think about trying to create a legacy, we talk about a science hub, for example. So a science hub might exist online, doesn't necessarily have to be a built building. We have plenty of locations across our region, Gunnedah, Tamworth, Dubbo, all over the place that have exhibition areas and all that type of stuff. But if there was a science hub where agri-sector scientists, you know, the cotton industry, the grain industry, different environmental groups, all different sectors could actually put their projects up on this science hub, and where they were seeking a creative to be involved, almost like a trading post or a clearing post or something where, so let's say, for example, somebody, and there's plenty of, we haven't got time, but there's plenty of stories of improvements in a particular agri sector. And I'll just pick the cotton industry. So if the cotton industry wanted a creative to be involved in a new process they're doing, or even to document an old process that they've actually improved, and that might be capturing chemicals on farm, or it might be the way they produce their cotton or whatever, they actually post their project seeking a creative to be involved. And obviously then finance, the relevant finance, they're prepared, dollars that they're prepared to put forward for that creative to come on board, automatically you'll get the creatives looking for things that float their boat. For example, Kim might see something that relates to her field, and Scott the same, and Rebecca the same. There's some money available to actually to get involved. It's not the creative trying to find the money from Arts Northwest, for example, but Arts Northwest would have a great role within the science hub because they have the connections with financials and the arts. So to me, after a period of time, I would think you, and this is an all online presence, after a period of time, you'd probably get a number of projects where creatives are embedded in those industries and talking about what they can do next. So then you start to fund, well, the funding's the thing that's the topic, but the funding also is there. So it's not the creatives, as I said before, trying to put the hat out to find some funding. It's the industries that want both the environment and the agri sector that want the creatives to be involved, are coming forward and are asking for creatives. And then if you actually take that step in, we're in this field now, online field, the whole technology that we've been talking about, all the technologies that we can actually bring to bear for the creative to do it, I think that's where we would create these legacies of the stories of where we've been. And after 27 years, I know where we've been on the Western floodplain and the areas that I've been working on. I know where we've got to now, and I believe I know where we're going to in the future. That would be the same story across many agri sectors, many environmental things, whether they're positive or negative, that's fine as well. So we've got habitats that have been lost, we've got species that are in decline, but they're the stories that could be put forward if this science hub, you know, was a useful way to actually bring creatives, bring the science sector linked to whether it's agriculture or the funding, and then the creatives to that project. So it's they're embedding without in a reverse way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I think that is a very important place, not just in terms of what projects can be created for the future, but in acknowledging and archiving and having as a resource the projects and things that have happened in the past. Because I'm conscious, Scott, potentially some of the areas in terms of you might be thinking of legacy is that next generation, those kids that are citizen scientists in your area, how you hope they might continue with this amazing science creativity collaboration in the future.
Yeah, the bioluminescence project is all about that. That over, you know, a few days, wherever we go across the regions, it's showing young people that their immediate environment is an amazing source of creativity. And then the video projection process and the video capture element is just one method for them to be able to kind of gauge with the stuff that they're walking past every day. Seeing it in a new light and then sharing it back to their community. So it becomes this kind of almost sort of self-sustaining system while giving them that experience in the creative industries that, you know, is a challenging aspect for that next generation to be able to access in the regions. We see, you know, all of those short courses from TAFE kind of, you know, disappearing off in the you know, financial rationalization process. And so, you know, what are those opportunities for that next generation to kind of go, I could be a scientist, but I could be an artist, and I could be an artist that actually works with the science.
Amazing. And Rebecca, I'd just like to bring you here again, just on sort of around your hopes for the legacy in terms of what you're producing in the written world. What do you hope that people who read your books take an action from that, whether that's as creative practitioners themselves or as down the science road?
For me, it's about those subtle messages and hoping that people finish the book, put it down and look at their environmental world with, you know, a different view where they become more appreciative of what's out there in the world. And, you know, if I can tap into even a small portion of the romance novel industry, which is a $1 billion industry globally, you know, I think that's the legacy that I'd like to leave behind. In Australia alone, romance novel sales increased by, I think, about 37% last year. And you've got authors
in the wrong field.
Yeah, you've got authors like, you know, Sarah J. Maas and Colleen Hoover, whether you like them or loathe them. You know, they're both writing in very different genres, but they have that romance element to their writing. In the last 12 years alone, Sarah J. Maas has sold over 40 million books. Colleen Hoover has sold 30 million books. You know, if I can tap into even a tiny portion of that market, you know, imagine how easily I could get across some of those environmental messages. And people wouldn't even necessarily know that they're distilling that scientific information if I write it in such a way that's quite organic to the story. That perhaps, you know, the reader is learning along with my female protagonist, which is generally how I write. So, yeah, that's, you know, my legacy is maybe people just look at their environment or appreciate other environments that they haven't come across yet.
It's also a really innovative approach to women working in STEM as well, this idea that we want to diversify the different ways that particularly women might want to sort of engage with, shape, communicate with the sciences. It's quite groundbreaking there in terms of blending some very sort of different worlds into one. So, yeah. Kim, I'd love to bring you in just as a final touchstone around legacy, and something that I know you're particularly passionate about is how we action this on a regional basis, how we continue to work in the regions, but how we provide direct impact to our regional communities. What do you see as the future for the arts and sciences in terms of that regional impact?
Look, I think, I mean, it's a hopeful future. Jane Richens mentioned in the chat that, you know, she's involved in a science hub, as is Scott, on the South Coast. We have nothing west of, I think, Cowra in terms of science hubs. I've tried to create science hubs, I guess, through the projects that I've done over the last few years, where as a creative, I've led the project that's drawn in different knowledge holders to work on a particular project over, you know, between usually 2 or 3 year period. But I also think we need to create stronger connections and find ways where those gaps are, which is pretty much where I'm based, and feel like I'm constantly pushing uphill to be taken seriously as a creative. Now, if I wore my rural journalist hat or I wore my agriculturalist hat, I mean, I was a farmer for 10 years during the Millennium Drought. Even if I wore that farmer hat, I'd be taken far more seriously than I am as a creative. And yet all of those experiences roll into my creative practice, along with new learning and new technology and the willingness to share that and share the stories that I draw from those communities and landscapes. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'll continue to do that, but it'd be nice to think it could get a little easier as I go forward. And so, you know, if we could just find ways of creating those connections and having the arts valued in that STEAM conversation, because even on the ABC yesterday, when I was introduced to talk about today's talk, they thought it was a typo that there was an A in STEAM. And I had to correct the presenter right off the bat. And so, again, it's the arts constantly trying to fight for that place at the table. And I think until that happens, it's going to continue to be a challenge. But, you know, every one of us who's sitting here today is passionate about what we do and passionate about the regions and the stories that they hold and offer. And we're passionate about creating a future for the regions. And we do that through our creative outlets that has a scientific foundation to it. So I think for me, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, as I'm sure everybody else will as well. But, you know, even if this conversation today creates stronger connections just between the four of us and those in the audience, then, you know, even this talk has started to open doors.
That's fabulous. And I think I certainly speak for someone who works in culture and government. I've learned an enormous amount by meeting all of you and the different interesting ways that we can shift the conversation. So I am profoundly re-educated. So I thank you for that. And I want to thank all of our panelists for being with us today. It's been really fascinating conversation and a very inspiring one about how we can use a lot more diverse ways to communicate to our communities and to actually action change, which is, I think, what something we all would love to do. So thank you so much to Daryl, Scott, Rebecca and Kim. Thank you very much for your time and your enthusiasm. Thank you to Arana Arts for being a great host. And thank you for everyone who has joined us today. There's lots of great websites and lots of links in the chat. Some amazing books by Rebecca for us all to purchase and have a read of. So please get out there, engage with your scientists and your artists, and let's change the world for better.